Well, as we reported last week, a 3-foot-tall tablet with 87 lines of Hebrew that scholars believe dates from the decades just before the birth of Jesus. It's causing quite a stir in biblical and archaeological circles, especially because it may speak of a Messiah who will rise from the dead after 3 days. In a moment, we talk about this and some other incredible archaeological discoveries with Dr. Ken Hansen next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Ken Hansen, author, lecturer, founder of Treasures in Time, an organization devoted to disseminating knowledge of the ancient times. And Ken has dug on archaeological sites in the Middle East, as well as taught Hebrew on an Israeli agricultural settlement. Dr. Hansen has been up close and personal with the face of terrorism and lends a timeless perspective to the challenges of the future. Dr. Ken Hansen, back on Coast to Coast. Ken, how are you?
Great. Good to be with you, George, and warm shalom from the University of Central Florida.
Oh, excellent. Man, we're into some incredible times these days, Ken.
Aren't we?
My gosh. Even since the last time we talked, it seems like the planet's upside down.
Ain't it the truth? Last time we spoke, as a matter of fact, we were talking about the recent discovery of the Judas Gospel, the Gospel of Judas. And I remember even then saying, you know, every now and then something out of the blue just rocks our whole world. And when we think that every last thing has been discovered that could possibly be discovered, especially with regard to the biblical world, along comes something new, something like this. And sure enough, we've got something new even as we speak this evening.
Many things to talk with you about tonight, including some angelic stories and issues. But let's talk then a little bit about this ancient Hebrew tablet that kind of kindles the Messiah debate. Explain, first of all, Ken, based on what you know, what this tablet, this 3-foot tablet is.
Yeah, well, I've been following this for a good year now, even as I've been writing my latest book that's to be released in September, and I've written actually about it in that book. But just in the last week, it's really hit the press in a big way because there's been an international conference going on in Jerusalem to mark the 60th anniversary of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is one of the major items on the agenda. Basically, it's a tablet. It's a stone tablet about 3 feet tall with Hebrew characters, 87 lines of it, which appear to have been composed at some point in the decades before the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. It's a stone that bears writing in ink, and that is really unusual. We have a lot of stone engravings from the ancient world. That's not so unusual, but to find something in ink on stone, we're looking at what amounts to a Dead Sea Scroll in stone. That's remarkable. If it's authentic.
How did they date it?
Well, that's part of the problem. And even as we speak, there's major concern about whether it might be a forgery. Some of my good colleagues are not at all convinced that this is authentic and say, how convenient that this text is written on stone, because you can't really carbon date stone now, can you?
No, you can't.
What are you going to do, scrape off the residue of ink and try to carbon date that? You destroy the very text that you're trying to date. How convenient for a forger. And we ought to just make everybody aware that there is a whole industry of forgery that swirls around in the world of archaeology. This is a business to forge ancient items of apparently great value and to pawn them off on an unsuspecting and naive world. But even bearing that in mind, I tend to vote yes on this. I think it's genuine. We don't have any smoking gun to prove it, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. It certainly is remarkable. We've got two neat columns of text that look in a way similar to how a Torah is written, the books of Moses in a modern synagogue, in columns that go right down a page, except again we're talking stone as opposed to parchment. The stone is broken, it's fractured, some of the writing appears to be faded. Now forgers can reproduce all of the above, so it's not a slam dunk. It does appear to have surfaced rather mysteriously, and that is, of course, cause for concern. We don't know who found it. Somebody found it apparently around 10 years ago, proceeded to sell it to an Israeli-Swiss antiquities collector who took it to his home in Zurich in Switzerland, where it sat around for 10 years. Looks very suspicious to some. And that person, again, in turn, sold it to a Jordanian antiquities dealer. And suddenly, it's in the public domain.
Yeah, do we know how much the Israeli paid for it?
No, we don't. Those things are held close to the vest. But it's not unusual that items like this are discovered anonymously. Some years back, there was a stone ossuary, basically a burial box to contain bones, and it had an engraving on the side of it, which purports to be James, the brother of Jesus. And we don't know who found that either. It just was discovered. It was taken to a little antiquity shop in the old city of Jerusalem, and then an Israeli collector picked it up and didn't even know what he had for the longest time until he really started looking at that inscription and realized this could in fact be the brother of Jesus. It hit the papers, the press, the whole archaeological world was rocked, and then what happened? Cries of forgery. And that whole thing is, as we speak, swirling around, still undecided.
Well, now let's assume it's real. Let's assume it's authentic. And if it indeed speaks of a Messiah who will rise from the dead after 3 days, much like the case of Jesus, what does that tell you, Ken?
Oh, my goodness. This is revolutionary. It's astounding if it's real. And
if
again,
real.
I tend to vote yes on it. Call me gullible, call me naive, but I've studied this for a good year now, and there are some prominent voices who are weighing in positively, examining the writing itself. And there's a whole science of ancient writing, ancient scriptology, if you will. And it really looks good on that level. But the implications, again, are overwhelming because we now have evidence in the Hebrew language of the concept of a messianic figure who will not triumph in the end, but in fact die, be slain, and then rise again in 3 days. Up until this time, this is Christian stuff. This is stuff that, of course, is in the New Testament. It's the kind of statements that we see Jesus uttering in the Gospels as we read them. But these are Greek Gospels. And, you know, even Christian scholars over generations now have seriously doubted whether Jesus actually made such claims. This is sort of the thing that would have been edited into the text by later writers, editors, clerics down through the ages, and we simply put them in the mouth of Jesus to make him seem like a prophet. Well, now we've got it in Hebrew, and everything has to change. Maybe, in fact, there was already this idea, this messianic concept floating around even before Jesus in the Jewish world. That changes a lot.
It sure does. It sure does. Now, let's talk a little bit, too, about a little bit more on this Gabriel revelation. Why do we call it the Gabriel revelation?
Because this whole text, 87 lines of it, focuses on the angel Gabriel in Hebrew. Gabriel, he's an angel featured prominently in the book of Daniel, and it's Gabriel who actually communicates this revelation and expresses sort of an end-time apocalyptic sense that, yes, there is a Messiah, but it's going to end catastrophically. And we've got actual words now in the mouth of Gabriel that are being quoted in this text where he says, Avdi David Bakesh Min Lifnei Ephraim. That's from the original Hebrew on this tablet. Translates as, my servant David, ask Ephraim. That alone is astounding. Who is David? David, King David. He's the Jewish prototype of the Messiah. Well, who is Ephraim? David, according to the Bible, had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, the more prominent being Ephraim. Joseph. Joseph had two sons. So we've got basically a prototype of two messiahs, a messiah son of David and a Messiah son of Joseph. And that alone is astounding. There's a very cryptic passage in the Babylonian Talmud centuries later. It's written in Aramaic, and it talks about, in fact, two messiahs, and talks about the Messiah, son of Joseph, who is slain. Messiah, son of Joseph, who is slain. Well, Jesus was, of course, the son of Joseph.
Yep. And he was slain.
And he was slain. And people have wondered, what is that doing in the Babylonian Talmud? This is a Jewish text. And last I checked into it, Jesus is not exactly considered to be the Messiah in the Jewish world. What does this relate to? And then here we've got in this new stone tablet reference to two messiahs, David, who's speaking to this other Messiah, son of Joseph. Messiah, son of Joseph. And then it goes on, and it says, L'shloshet yamin, in 3 days. And followed by that, we've got the name Gabriel itself. 3 days, and it says, I, Gabriel. And again, the text is faded. It's hard to make out. But then we find a very curious word. It says, Chaye, in the Hebrew. We think it says, Chaye. It has a rather unusual spelling. You kind of have to be a linguist to go into that. But it still looks like this word we would pronounce chaye, that means live. So if we can reconstruct the text, Gabriel is speaking and saying, in 3 days you shall live. I, Gabriel, command you, in 3 days you shall live. And you get goosebumps, honestly.
Oh, you do. You really do. Now, this is called the Dead Sea Scroll because it was found in that region, much like the Dead Sea Scroll on stone.
Dead Sea Scroll in stone. It's not exactly a Dead Sea Scroll, but apparently found in the region
close.
Of the Dead Sea.
Do you think it was written by the Essene?
Actually, there's another explanation. And you have to go into a little bit of history for this.
Okay.
It seems there was a great revolt against the Roman conquerors of Judea that took place right after the death of King Herod the Great. We all have heard of King Herod, the New Testament king who tried to slaughter all the infants to make sure that no Messiah would come and threaten his rule.
Yeah. Kill the firstborn, right?
Yeah, that's right. King Herod, we know from history, died in the year 4 BC. And according to the ancient historian Josephus, there was a massive revolt that broke out immediately after his death that tried to free the whole land of Judea from Roman rule. It was a power vacuum. It was led by a mysterious figure that we've only heard of from Josephus. His name was Shimon, or Simon.
Simon.
He started this revolt and rose up in great power. It spread all over the land, but of course the Romans didn't mess around. The Emperor Augustus sent in his legions. They put it down ferociously. Simon himself, we're told, was crowned as a king somewhere in Transjordan, across the Jordan River. And he apparently had messianic significance attached to him. They were looking to this new king to free them from the Roman Empire. Well, it didn't quite go down the way they had hoped. He was apprehended, ultimately beheaded. And yet, how were his followers going to cope with this tragedy, with this catastrophe? There's a new type of messianism, of messianic idea that seems to rise up during those difficult days, and we call it catastrophic messianism. Messianism is usually thought of as triumph. The Messiah will come and bring triumph and freedom and world peace, etc. Well, maybe eventually, but first there's going to be a catastrophe. And so apparently the followers of this new king, this Messiah figure of theirs, Simon, coped with it in this way. They said, look, he has died, and yet here we have this vision from the angel Gabriel who's saying, you're going to rise up in 3 days. And in fact, good will triumph over evil. You may not see it now. You may not see it with your physical eye, but Righteousness is going to triumph over evil. It's only a delay. Catastrophic messianism, that was already an idea that was floating around even before Jesus. So this is the new thing. Jesus of Nazareth comes along and embraces that thought, brings it to himself and says, look, my mission is part of this. Also, a catastrophe that we can expect. I'm going to be delivered into the hands of the Romans. But you can believe that I will come back also, that there will be a new righteousness and power that comes out of my own demise. Again, the scholarly world has poo-pooed all of this kind of wording from the mouth of Jesus, saying, again, people, they added this in centuries later. Jesus would never have said this, right? But maybe he in fact did. Maybe, in fact, he was aware of this tradition. Maybe he was embracing this himself, applying it now to himself in a messianic way, which means that Jesus was, in fact, making a rather bold messianic claim. Again, the implications go on and on and on.
If this is a forgery, what is it to force? Anything? It continues to create the debate with more people believing than not. But if it's a forgery, what happens?
Well, it leaves us right back in the typical scholarly muddle that we're always in. And even if it's a forgery, I'm glad for it, because anything that provokes debate and serious thought and question is always worth it, in my opinion. But it leaves us with these curious passages in the Babylonian Talmud. Again, these are Jewish writings centuries after Jesus, written in Aramaic. This curious passage, the Messiah, son of Joseph, is slain. And then it goes on in the Talmud and says, I ask of you only the gift of life. Messiah, son of Joseph, slain, gift of life. We still have that problem. We still have that question. What is the Babylonian Talmud doing talking about this slain Messiah? Maybe, in fact, this was already a motif, as we call it, an idea, a theme that was in the Jewish world already. Jesus was way more Jewish, let me tell you, than most people have any idea.
Ken, I want to talk about end times prophecy a little bit later on this hour and also get your take on the angelic realm and what you think this means. The stories themselves that we find in the Bible, educate us a little bit. How did we end up finding them? Were they just passed down over the ages, or did they get discovered at a certain time period? What happened?
Well, the stories in the Bible are a whole science in and of themselves. A lot of them apparently were passed down orally, but as with everything, there's huge debate in the scholarly world. Was this just so much folklore that was shifted around and altered willy-nilly whenever they pleased? Was this something that was faithfully carried on? Okay, so it was passed down orally. Maybe it was memorized in such a way that word for word, the tradition was passed down. Unfortunately, the textual evidence doesn't go any further back than the Dead Sea Scrolls. Those are the oldest texts of the Bible that exist in the world. They go back over 2,000 years, and they show an incredible line of textual continuity from 2,000 years ago to the present day. The text has been stable. It hasn't changed virtually at all, word for word, identical. What it looked like before the Dead Sea Scrolls, well, that's where we get into our debates. We have the minimalist camp.
Let's talk about both of that, Ken. We're going to come right back. This is important. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Dr. Ken Hansen with us. Ken, we were talking about the Bible itself and the discovery and then the Dead Sea Scrolls as well. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls were found between 47 and 1979, right, in about 11 caves?
Exactly. 1947 was the first of them. And again, now, discovered by accident, as so many great discoveries are.
All right, so let's, prior to then, that discovery, mm-hmm. What did people know about the Bible?
Well, the oldest texts in the world known to exist prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls were medieval. When we're talking about the Hebrew Bible, that is the Old Testament for Christians, we're talking about the Aleppo Codex. It was found in Syria and dates from around 980 or so A.D. That's a medieval text. That was the oldest text we had of the Bible. And so it was anybody's guess what the text looked like before that. And of course, the minimalists came along who tried to minimalize everything. Their basic adage is, if it's in the Bible, it must not be true. And of course, made outlandish claims that it had been altered drastically. Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, changed the landscape. And now we've got this continuity of text going way back over 2,000 years to the first 2 centuries B.C., and they're almost word-for-word identical. Not exactly, but almost.
Give me your take, then, on what you think happened a long time ago with the angelic realm. And then we'll talk about, for example, your thoughts on the angel Gabriel again. But
yeah, sure.
I'd really love to get your take on just what do you think happened? How did it start?
Well, we see more and more emphasis, even in the Bible, plus the extra-biblical texts that we've got, lots of books that never made the cut of the Bible that emphasize angels, the realm of the angelic. And we can almost pinpoint when this happened, and it seems to have happened at the time of the great Babylonian conquest of ancient Israel, when Solomon's temple was destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia and the people were taken into captivity in the 500s BC. This was a terrible catastrophe, and just about synonymous with those events, we see this emphasis on the angelic. Even Ezekiel, who was among the first of those exiles taken into captivity, sees the heavens opened and the angelic realm displayed before him. It's part of this concept that we see now echoed in this stone tablet that we're talking about of catastrophic messianism. The idea is that, yes, the Messiah is coming, but there's a catastrophe first. Will the Messiah come as a lion or will he come as a lamb? And the answer is both. Both. That we expect this time of travail, and the angels are there to mediate the pain that we're experiencing. It's almost as if we didn't need them as much until this time of trial and woe. And by the way, I would love to add that the Christian world has long labored under the misconception that the Jews as a whole rejected Jesus because he wasn't the kind of Messiah that they expected. They expected a conquering Messiah, and he was a humble Messiah, and so therefore the Jews rejected Jesus, and this is so wrong. And by the way, has led to centuries of Christian anti-Semitism, sadly to say. This stone tablet proves that the idea of a suffering Messiah, even a Messiah who would die, was already there, was already in Judaism. And the Jews did not reject Jesus. My new book is about that. There was a massive movement that held exactly to these ideas that we see now in the stone tablet.
The Sanhedrin might have, but the rest of them probably did not.
Well said, George. When we're talking about the rejection of Jesus, we're talking about a small elite group, the Sanhedrin, dominated by the priestly circles, the Sadducee sect that a lot of people have read about in the New Testament. Yeah, they were Jesus' natural enemies and antagonists, but guess what? The majority of the Jews of that day, including the Pharisee party, also saw them as antagonists. They hated this rich, fat cat elite. They were on Jesus' side. So we have to be very careful in calling Jews as rejectionists of Jesus, and this has been used as an excuse for Jew baiting down through the centuries. And as a Judaic scholar, it's one of the things, even in my classes at the university, that we really need to address. And now we've got a new piece of archaeology on our side. It's just mind blowing.
When we read about Ezekiel and his vision of this turning wheel in the sky, mm-hmm. a lot of people on this program have speculated we're talking about a UFO, a flying saucer, something extraterrestrial. What's your take on that part, Ken? Something like
certainly
that.
Extraterrestrial. In the philosophical world, we call such things other, meaning ultimately non-earthly, not of this realm, this world, this dimension. So at that point, we step back and we leave it and we say, we don't know. We can say what the meaning of it is, and that is that the text is shouting at us that the divine presence, however we experience God, however we experience the divine, is released from Jerusalem. God appears outside of the Holy Land to this man in captivity, in exile. Why, up until then, God lived in the temple, in Jerusalem only. Now, it's like God is let out of the box through this incredible otherworldly vision that he has. And you call it extraterrestrial. It certainly is that, however you want to interpret extraterrestrial. One of my favorite adages is that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Ken, you bring in archaeology in a lot of your work. When you look at science and try to mix it with true biblical information,
sure.
Is it a fight even within yourself to either go toward the science or to go through the true biblical circles?
Yes, within myself, beyond myself, with my colleagues. I'm headed to Israel, in fact, just one day hence, leading a group there. And it's swirling. Even in the land of Israel, the biblical archaeology department at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, headed by my colleague Shalom Paul, in Jerusalem, it's exploding. It's exploding with students, with graduate students who take a minimum 10 years to get through the program. It's that rigorous. We don't care. It's that exciting. It's a swirling controversy. And, yeah, sure, inside myself also, because on the one hand, I'm always searching for a meaning, for something that will enhance, lift us out and beyond ourselves, even on a mystical level, and that's well and good. On the other hand, and by the way, I'm also a student of Kabbalah, and there's a bit of mysticism in this tablet, too, I'd like to tell you about. But on the other hand, we have to be responsible, and in the academic world and as a Judaic scholar, everything has to be tempered with what we can show, what we can prove, what we can substantiate, and that's a science, even when it comes to texts.
Do you question yourself in terms of what are we doing here? Why are we here? What's our mission?
Oh, yeah. And it's a balancing act in the classroom as well, because we're not out to endorse religion or theism or anything like that. We're just to teach about faith and religion and Judaism, etc., Christianity, teach about them in a dispassionate way, in an objective way, as much as possible. And yet the very nature of this stuff, it does its work for us. We don't have to endorse anything. The very fact that we're studying this material tends to pull people beyond themselves. Even as we talked about this vision of Ezekiel, whether it was, certainly it was an extraterrestrial presence of some kind, it was a UFO or simply the divine. You can't study a text like this without being pulled out of yourself. And I've seen transformative experiences taking place even among my own students in our classroom.
Even the Vatican said a month ago, they said, belief in extraterrestrial life does not negate or harm one's belief system in God. And it was pretty dramatic for them to come out and say that, Ken.
Absolutely. Sure. And a lot of people criticize the Vatican, and there are umpteen theories about the Vatican conspiring to suppress this or that. I'm kind of defensive of the Vatican. The Vatican has sponsored a lot of very good science and a lot of very good archaeology and has really been pretty open. Let's find out what we can about this incredible universe that we inhabit. And God has nothing to be afraid of. Why should we?
Like these tablets, or this tablet here was with the collector, yeah. Do you think the Ark of the Covenant may be in somebody's basement somewhere that he's got hidden away, or the Holy Grail?
Well, I'm writing a novel about that now.
Oh, really?
That's good stuff for novels.
Sure is.
And any number of places where the Ark of the Covenant might have ended up, from directly underneath the Temple Mount and the Dome of the Rock, as one of my colleagues thinks, to, according to one of these books that never made it into the Bible, the prophet Jeremiah carted it away, even as the Temple of Solomon that we just talked about was being destroyed, carted it off into the desert and buried it in a cave. And there it waits, there it reposes until the end of days, when it will at last be revealed for all of humanity as part of a great end time event.
Aren't there many Dead Sea Scrolls that haven't been announced to us yet, or even deciphered?
Well, there was sort of a conspiracy of silence for decades regarding an enormous hoard of fragments of these scrolls that were in fact sequestered away. I'm not going to blame the Vatican like some people do. All you have to do is understand the scholarly mentality of my fellow scholars who, I don't know, if somebody gave me the most important documents in the world, I probably wouldn't be in a rush to get out and publish them. I'd make sure that I sequestered them for a long time and wrote every last word in my own multi-volume thesis before I released them. And that's essentially what the scholars were doing. It's just greed, essentially. Didn't want to let them out. And so for decades, this hoard of thousands of these fragments, some extremely important, just languished in the basement of the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem. What a story. But they have come out in the last decade, a little over a decade. They have come out in a flood, a trickle at first, but pretty much all of them now are out in the public domain. It's still a question of how we assemble all of them, because you got the world's biggest jigsaw puzzle here.
Absolutely.
Even having released them now, you can even find them on the internet. All the fragments, they're out there. They're now, thank God, they're at last published. But that doesn't mean that we understand them. That doesn't mean, if you got a little tiny fragment of a piece of some larger text, we don't even know what text it was from. Imagine trying to piece them together and make sense of them. It's like this tablet.
Okay, now, is it possible that there could be more Dead Sea Scrolls in caves that just haven't been discovered yet?
And every time somebody asks me that, I tend to think unlikely, very unlikely. Which is what I thought the last time we spoke on this show about the Judas Gospel. Unlikely.
And then we find more things.
So my feeling, as always, is unlikely, and I'm sure in a few months I'll be proven wrong once again.
See, I would say this is a very big planet, and there are a lot of caves, never know. What did we learn, Ken, from the Dead Sea Scrolls that we didn't know prior to their discovery?
We learned a lot about the folklore of this period, beyond even the Bible texts themselves that these scrolls preserve with uncanny precision. We learned the kind of things that people sat around the campfire talking about. I call it the tabloid journalism of ancient Judea. And it really was that. A lot of the stuff is what we would call pretty far out. But then again, how much of these ideas informed early Christianity, ideas especially about the Messiah? And one text that I'm always just enthralled with, a psalm from the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is a psalm that never made it into the biblical book of Psalms, but talks about the children who have come to the throes of death, and then speaks of a woman who labors in pains to bear a man in the midst of this fiery crucible. And again, you get goosebumps, and you think about these ideas written before Jesus ever came along, but which seem uncannily to describe what we talked about before, catastrophic messianism, a Messiah who would not be a great conqueror, or one who would succeed at least in overthrowing Rome, but one who would himself be born in travail, very nearly escape death at the hands of this monster, King Herod, and ultimately die, as the tablet says, And here I am, a Judaic scholar, defending Jesus and defending some of these Christian traditions. It's fine, because we need to see the historical Jesus in his context. And so much of early Christianity is really informed by the Dead Sea Scrolls as a Jewish movement. The Jewish scholars are now studying it actively, probably for the first time in history.
If the scrolls had never been discovered, where would we be today?
In the dark.
Truly?
In a lot of ways. Yeah, in a lot of ways. Yeah, we'd still be debating how much even the regular traditional Bibles have changed down through the centuries. You know, the earliest text we have is medieval. Isaiah probably didn't even look like Isaiah before the Middle Ages, and the minimalists would be shouting louder and louder about that. So on every level, we've got a window on the ancient world and really on some of the most pivotal times in human history, the very creation of the three dominant civilizations of the Western world. Judaism, Christianity, and even Islam is directly informed, believe it or not, by the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is remarkable. Many of the concepts of Islam come right out of the Dead Sea Scrolls, can you imagine?
I'm told the scrolls were sold for $250,000 back in 1954. Is that true?
To an Israeli professor who happened to be visiting in the United States at the moment.
They were like auctioned off or something like that?
It's a long story. They made their way to the United States via a certain Christian archbishop in Jerusalem, who in turn had purchased them from an antiquities dealer from Bethlehem.
That's amazing.
From hand to hand, and that's common. Again, we're talking about a similar story with this stone. How you go?
And they were found by what, goat herders, either one or two young Bedouins,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Right. We've got the name of one of them, Muhammad Ad-Dib, who was one of the goat herders who claims to have found the first one. And then he and his friend went back and discovered some more, and ultimately brought them to Bethlehem. This was after they had traveled around with the Bedouin in the desert in a burlap sack for several weeks. And that was the beginning of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Can you imagine?
I mean, some of the scrolls, Genesis, the Book of Enoch, everything. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got fragments, at least fragments, from each and every book of the Hebrew Bible. And in terms of when it comes to Isaiah, it's the complete, entire book of Isaiah, complete and entire, whole, and fragments of every single other one except for the book of Esther, not to mention a hoard of texts like the Psalm I mentioned that never made it into the Bible. We didn't even know existed until the middle of the 20th century, and yet with these haunting messianic ideas right in the heart of ancient Judaism.
Is it possible that these authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls were tremendous playwrights, great storytellers of their time?
Sure. I think in those days, as I mentioned, this is tabloid journalism, and they had nothing better to do at night than sit around the campfire and tell their stories. After all, there was no MTV in those days. So what do you do on those?
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Ken. Because I want you to tell us how many people you think contributed to writing those Dead Sea Scrolls, and then we'll talk about end times as well and angels, and then your phone calls with Dr. Ken Hansen in the last hour of the show. So we know the Essene wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, Ken. What do we know about them? Who were they?
Yeah, here we have a rather mysterious group of ancient Judeans who came together sometime in the first 2 centuries B.C. during some very tumultuous times. This catastrophe that I've mentioned already seems to have sparked a lot of spiritual vitality. There was a very ruthless Syrian king who had conquered Judea. Judea has been conquered I don't know how many times during history. And this was a period of intense persecution during which the most pious of the ancient Israelites, the Hasidics or the Hasidim, remind us of our black-coated friends today who also call themselves Hasidic. These were ancient Hasidic Jews who fled, according to the historian Josephus, out into the desert during this time of intense persecution. It was, in fact, the first truly religious persecution in history, in world history. took place from the years 168 to 164 BC. And somewhere around this time, the Dead Sea sect began. They may have been an offshoot of these pietistic Jews. Of course, that's debated, as everything is. That's what I lean to. Maybe some branch of these ancient Hasidics decided to settle by the shores of the Dead Sea. And over time, adopted this term Essene, we think, although the Dead Sea Scrolls never used the term. This is simply conjecture on the part of the scholars.
Okay.
They established their own community. They imagined themselves living on the edge of eternity, awaiting the Messiah to come. And actually, they believed in not one, but two Messiahs. And here we are back to that stone tablet again, which seems to mention two. This is the only ancient Jewish group that actively taught the idea of a priestly Messiah and a Davidic Messiah. One Messiah from the line of King David, another from the priestly line. And they established their own communal settlement, a kind of an ancient kibbutz, if you can think of an Israeli agricultural settlement. They lived there and in the caves, wrote these scrolls, and persisted for a couple of centuries in this unforgiving, merciless desert heat.
Ken, assuming as we were chatting at the top of the hour that they were great storytellers, how many people had to get together to put together the Dead Sea Scrolls to write the tale?
Well, the community itself probably numbered, say, a couple of hundred souls at any given time.
All right.
And the historian Josephus tells us that they were celibate, in fact, although that as well is debated. But you can imagine perhaps a couple of hundred guys, a couple of hundred males celibate who did nothing but write these scrolls day and night and produce their own library. They may have collected scrolls from elsewhere in the country also. If we're going to establish a library today, we're going to collect all manner of different literature. But then they copied it in their own hand and they made it part of their own library. So we've got stories in the traditional Bible, but we can supplement them now from all these with all these other tales that never made the cut, and here they are in the Dead Sea Scrolls. One project that I'm working on over the long haul is to put together sort of an Essene version of the Book of Genesis, what the earliest Book of Genesis probably looked like to the ancient Essene sect. That's a mind blower.
Assuming that they put all these together and they're truthful, where did they get the information to write the many books?
These people were walking computers when it came to their literature. They were highly literate, for one thing. And that's unique about ancient Israelites. There was a saying that he who buys a Jewish slave has bought himself a master. They had a literacy rate that was higher than our own today, in fact. And they did nothing but study and train from very early ages. So these people had an exhaustive knowledge, and really the rank and file, even the lower classes, had a huge knowledge of the biblical text and the stories that grew up as a folklore. And some of them were considered more authoritative than others. Some of these texts, some of these stories, were in fact considered Bible to them and are not considered Bible in our day and age. In other words, they got decanonized at some point. But there was a consensus of the community. I guess that's the best way to explain it. When the community itself and the rank and file of ancient Israelites pretty well agreed that a book like Daniel is divinely inspired, and they didn't just study it, they memorized it.
Why is the angel Gabriel so important to your work and probably to a lot of others?
Well, he figures very prominently sort of as a messenger angel. The name Gabriel means mighty one of God, or perhaps my God is mighty. Gever is the root of it, from Gabriel, a mighty one, like a macho type character, who has served in the biblical text as archangel, also messenger, one who communicates important revelations, important truths, and figures prominently then not just in Judaism but in Christianity, where he announces the birth of John the Baptist and Jesus also to the Virgin Mary, but also in Islam he is figured. Jibril, he's called in the Islamic faith. And all these seem to be linked together. He's just a very important supernatural character who delivers these messages. Whenever you have a message to convey, send Gabriel.
Yeah, why is it his role? Why is it his role to do that?
So he has been designated, perhaps because of his character. It takes strength, power, to be able to intercede even through a host of other angelic battles, as it were. That's how he's depicted in the book of Daniel, where we read, "There stood before me as the appearance of a man, and I heard the voice of a man." And it said, Gabriel, and Gabriel is mentioned. "Make this man to understand the vision." So that's his character. He's got strength and power sufficient to cut through any interference in the supernatural realm and to communicate understanding of visions.
Is there still anything about all this, Ken, and you've done a lot of work here over the years, that baffles you still?
I'm endlessly intrigued and baffled at the same time. It's a landscape of contradiction and conflict, but really that's the beauty of it. You never get bored when you do what I do. There's endless things to debate. It's like entering a big courtroom. I compare it that way to my students a lot. And you know that you have adversaries, even in the scholarly realm, who will debate every single point. And sure, I'm baffled a lot. What were these ancients trying to communicate to us? What can we absorb from them today? That I struggle with a lot, you know, because we want to, yes, study these as ancient literature, but most people want to say, now what can I gain from it? So I work not only in the academic realm, but in the public arena to try to enlighten folks as to what we can walk away with, how we can apply this. And that, I grant, is a real struggle. How can we make sense of this today?
Are you convinced that the biblical flood of Noah, that happened, that David and Goliath happened, that, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah happened, that, you know, Saul's wife was turned into a pillar of salt? Did these things really happen, or are they stories?
Yeah, good question. And, again, my minimalist scholar friends will trounce on all of it. And even to grant a shred of credence in the scholarly world puts you in instant jeopardy, to be honest. But I personally like to take the stories seriously as much as possible. And again, my adage is, absence of evidence doesn't mean absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Just because we don't have a smoking gun to prove that something happened, well, that doesn't mean it didn't automatically. So if you have a text, I try to grant as much credence to the text as possible. These are ancient documents. Now, I don't mean to evade the question. I think that a lot of these things have at least kernels of truth behind them. If they're embellished, so what? If they're a little bit embellished, or even a lot embellished. We know there were floods all over the ancient Near East. Did someone just make up the idea of a massive flood out of the clear blue? Or was there really at least a regional inundation?
Right.
I like to think of the inundation that created what we call the Black Sea today. And we know there were ancient civilizations underneath there, or remains of ancient civilization underneath the level of the Black Sea. That kind of massive catastrophe, I think, is behind this sort of story. There are others you mentioned. What about Goliath? I like to grant credence to that as well. This is a wonderful case in point, because our minimalist friends say, well, how could a person that tall ever have actually lived in history? He would have been well over 9 feet tall. Come on now, be real. Well, lo and behold, we have a little fragment of Dead Sea Scroll right at the Goliath story that has a minor difference with the book of of Samuel, 1 Samuel, that talks about the Goliath story. And Goliath comes in at about 6 feet 9 inches tall, not over 9 feet tall. So all of a sudden, we bring him down to size a little bit, and sure, it's possible that there was such a figure. So it's the bottom line is it's so easy to be skeptic and to doubt all of these stories and trounce on them, and it's even popular to do that. But I think the pendulum may be swinging back in the other direction.
Finally. Took long enough, though, didn't it?
It sure did. But that's why I say the archaeology field at the Hebrew University, as we speak, is exploding. And this is it's a huge question that has important ramifications, even for the modern state of Israel. What are we doing here in this land after we wandered around for 2,000 years? Is it just a fluke that we ended up back here? Do we have any roots in this land at all? Is our entire heritage about this great King David just something that was made up in the Hellenistic age? Or is there something to this, and can we confirm it even in the stones that we uncover?
Why have we had so many wars, Ken, over religion, and continue to?
Ooh, yeah, I deal with that a lot. Because it seems that people have focused way too much on what a text means instead of how it's telling us to live. And this is a particularly Western phenomenon, by the way. Even psychoanalysis tells us that the human mind is uniquely capable of holding ideas in tension, in conflict, without ever needing to resolve them. We're really unique in being able to do that, and yet somehow the Western mind wants to resolve everything, and either it happened this way or it didn't happen at all, and you must accept this completely and totally or else it's all worthless, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the kind of black and white reasoning that sadly has provoked the very kind of conflicts that we've seen all through history. Instead of trying to figure out the text means this exactly and it can't mean anything else, and if you don't agree with it exactly in this way, then you're doomed, etc. Why don't we ask, what is it telling us in terms of how to live our lives? Let's be more open. Let's even look at some of these texts, as I do, that never made it into the Bible. And whether or not they ought to be in the canon of the Bible doesn't matter. What's the message that it's conveying to us as to how we need to live our lives today? Not what we think, not what we believe, but how we live.
What one question would you like answered if you could rub a genie's lamp and out the genie would pop to be able to give you the answer to anything you wanted? What would that be?
Well, at this moment, I'd want to know about that stone, to be honest. It changes
really? Every
day, George. I'm fascinated with that, first and foremost, as we speak. You know, is this thing genuine? And if it is, you know, what are the ramifications of that? Even in terms of this whole question of mysticism and Kabbalah, my goodness, there's a verse in this stone that talks about the blood of the slain being a chariot up to God. If this is authentic, it's mind-blowing. That word in Hebrew, chariot, is merkavah, and it's the earliest form of Jewish mysticism, a whole trend in mysticism that compares it to Elijah's chariot going up into heaven. And it's saying that even in catastrophe, the blood of the slain can be transformed into a spiritual renewal. And that ultimately that would be what Jesus is trying to say at the Last Supper. My blood is not about how you're wallowing in sin and need to be delivered from original sin. It's about transformative power. It's about this mystical idea of the chariot, like Elijah going up into heaven. If I could rub a genie's lamp, I'd want to know if this is authentic.
Or just some kind of a parable or something.
Yeah, as the detractors are saying, it's hot.
Madonna practices the Kabbalah.
Yeah.
What distinguishes that from traditional teachings?
Yeah, I was just interviewed, in fact, today about Madonna and her current woes and what about Kabbalah. You can check that out in the newsstands on Thursday. Can I say this? Star Magazine.
Absolutely. You are going to be in Star Magazine?
Yeah.
Okay.
In an article about Madonna. I'm sympathetic, actually, to the whole Kabbalah movement, and I just recently was out at the Kabbalah Center in Los Angeles. And what distinguishes from Judaism, when you go into a Kabbalah service, it's a lot like very orthodox traditional Judaism, but way beyond that. It is you can feel an energy and a power, and that's why we call it mysticism. It's not just this rote tradition and ritual. It's about connecting with something beyond yourself, and you just feel the vibe. It's incredible.
See, when I think about mysticism, Ken, I think about Merlin the Magician. And people like that. Am I off base on that?
Well, there's all different angles of mysticism, and I suppose, yeah, you could call that mysticism, definitely. There's mysticism in every major religious trend worldwide, and I, in fact, call it the golden thread that unites world religions. People say, oh, don't all the religions point in the same direction? I'm sorry, they don't. If you look at the doctrines that they teach, like we were talking about a minute ago, they go in all different directions, and that's why people fight wars about them. But if you want to find that golden thread, look at the mystical angle through all of them. There's not a religion anywhere, from the Sufis in Islam to Christian mystics to the Jewish Kabbalists, that are not trying to find that link with something beyond, this other, going back to Ezekiel and his vision. You know, you can think of that as a UFO. You can also think of it as the very fountainhead of the whole mystical stream in the ancient world. Everything flowed from Ezekiel's vision. You let the heavens be open, and you try to have this contact with something other that is not of this universe. And that's, you can say, the ultimate spiritual metaphysical experience.
Ken, tell us a little bit about your work and where you can get it.
I've written several books. My fifth now is called James and the Lost Heirs of Jesus. And I'm really excited about this because as a Jewish scholar, I'm looking at the Jesus movement within Judaism, and I'm actually tracing the descendants of Jesus, not to the West, as the Da Vinci Code does, but to the East. There was a whole dynasty of the whole family, the literal descendants of Jesus' family, his brother James and a line of them, who ruled and reigned in the Jesus movement in Judaism in the East, in Jordan and beyond, for centuries, that has been literally lost, cut off by the Western Church, and all but forgotten. And so I've done a lot of research to reconstruct it in a very accessible way. I'm very excited about it. It's going to be released in September, the grand release nationwide, but it's already available on Amazon.
You make sure. Okay, very good. We'll be back with more in a moment. The Book of Revelation, End Times. Dr. Ken Hansen, did you investigate that?
Very much, and I deal a lot with that in my new book, because I think that its immediate application was to the heirs of the Jesus dynasty, as I mentioned before the break, the family of Jesus, who were living through their own time of trial and catastrophe. And these, I believe, were coded messages originally to them.
So many people believe we're in end times now, yet so many civilizations and eras always thought they were in end times, that the apocalypse was near. What makes this one any different right now?
Well, precisely, and that's why I write in my book about how the people in that day were convinced that these were messages to them. And if you were living through the great revolt that broke out in the first century AD, 66 through 70 of the Common Era against the Roman Empire, if anything looked like a great tribulation in the end time, that did. It left the city of Jerusalem in total ruin. It was leveled to the ground. The temple destroyed. More than 1 million Israelites dead from famine, starvation, and the sword. And this little brave sect of ancient Judeans the Nazarene movement, the Jesus movement, managed to find their way out of the city because they left at exactly the right time, believing that those messages in the book of Revelation were for them, and coded messages telling them when to leave and where to go.
You know, based on the population of the time, a million dead then might have been what now? 20 million? Who knows?
It's hard to believe, and some even doubt Josephus, the historian, when he says that a million Jews died. But I don't. It was just that bad. I can't tell you what percent of the Jewish population it was, but it was enormous. And it produced such cataclysm. If you read the book of Revelation against the history of Josephus, it really dovetails in ways that you really need to understand before you try to apply it to the current day. So many of these things are cyclical. In other words, the idea of a catastrophe. I talked earlier about catastrophic messianism. These things repeat over and over again in history. But you need to understand the earlier fulfillments before you look to anything beyond. And this is what we're often missing. We don't know our history. It talks about the Sea of Galilee, for example, in Josephus's history turned into a film of blood. Well, I'm going to be there in just a few days, and we actually have a boat that was found in the mud because the level of the lake had gone down so much, and some Israelis found this ancient boat sticking out of the mud. They called it the Jesus boat, but it may have been involved in that enormous revolt that literally turned the sea to blood. Well, then you read the book of Revelation, and what does it talk about? A third of the sea shall be turned into blood, et cetera, et cetera. It talks about people dying of starvation and thirst. Well, there was a massive heat wave right in the middle of that great revolt that left people dying of thirst. Wormwood is an image in the book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. Thrown into the water. The wells had gone dry, and people were sucking them dry and then getting typhus and dysentery and all kinds of disease. They didn't have enough water to drink. These are uncanny descriptions of that horrific revolt.
Didn't they also find a chariot or a wheel of a chariot somewhere in the Red Sea? You could picture Moses parting that. In Pharaoh's chariots get stuck. I think they found one.
Well, a lot of the archaeology has taken place actually underwater, and that's one possible find at another part of the Red Sea, not the traditional part, but several of things that look like chariot wheels. So, that's the world of archaeology, and even underwater archaeology. A lot is down there.
In terms of the calendar and when end times begins. Some believe that it begins when Israel is reconstituted as a nation, which was what, 1948?
1948.
Does that mean that's a trigger point here for end times?
It depends who you talk to. Maybe. Certainly, you look at the Middle East today, and what have we had since 1948? Again, I'm going there just one day hence, and even as we speak, there's all manner of crisis looming. The Iran situation, we're in the midst of I talked about a terrible drought. Well, we've got that again in the land, and not enough water to drink, and the lake is so low. It's just clouds looming, and there is this concept in Kabbalah, in Jewish mysticism, called the pangs of the Messiah. And again, it dovetails with what we've been talking about, that while people think or have thought historically of the Messianic Age as this wonderful, glorious time in the near future that the Messiah will usher in, well, in mysticism, there are pangs first, before that, birth pangs, as it were. There's an actual term, chevle Mashiach, the pangs, the travail, almost like the earth is struggling in pain to give birth to the Messianic Age. But before the happy birth comes the pangs. So how many times have we had pangs through history? Cyclical periods, haven't we, of pangs? Just like birth pangs, they come in waves. And maybe this is another wave.
A lot of biblical historians say that the Valley of Jehoshaphat is where the Battle of Armageddon will be. Do you interpret that at all in anything that you've studied, Ken?
One of the places we'll be visiting just a few days hence is a place called Megiddo or Har Megiddo. And right next to that, you can call it the Valley of Jehoshaphat poetically.
Uh-huh.
Jehoshaphat is the broad Jezreel Valley that this ancient city, a tell, as we call it, called Har Megiddo, the hill or mountain of Megiddo, guarded strategically. And it's along the broad trade route that stretched all the way from Egypt up to Damascus, called the Way of the Sea or the Via Maris. It's hugged the Mediterranean coastline, and then right about the Jezreel Valley, right about where Megiddo is situated, it curved inward and up toward the Sea of Galilee and on into Syria. So imagine the strategic area crisscrossing the heartland of northern Israel, and armies would maraud back and forth historically down through the centuries. That's why it's called in the Bible Galilee of the Gentiles, incidentally, because so many Gentile armies would literally maraud back and forth across that strategic area. So there's all kinds of imagery connected with Megiddo. It's an incredible archaeological site, and as I say, I'll be there with my group.
What about the Antichrist? Some say that he has already been born. What do you think?
And the New Testament says that many Antichrists have come. And reading it as a Jewish book, and again with the history in mind, there are cycles of these things. We talked about the beginning of the Essene sect in our discussion here. That took place in the first century B.C. during the period of a very wicked Syrian king. His name was Antiochus Epiphanes, that's what history calls him. He was the prototype of the Antichrist. So that even when the New Testament, as a Jewish book, talks about the Antichrist, it's looking backward first before it looks forward. That's why I say before we look at current history or try to apply these things to our own day, let's study the original application, the ancient history. There have been many Antichrists, says Epistle of John. Has the Antichrist been born? Maybe more than one.
Yeah. That's true. So it doesn't sound like you believe we're in end times right now.
Yes and no. We've been in end times repeatedly through history, and that's the thing. And if I were among the descendants of Jesus' family that I write about in my new book, this dynasty, I would have correctly perceived the day in which I lived as the end times, and I would have been absolutely right in doing so. And I would have interpreted those prophecies and those oracles as a message to get out of Dodge, to get out of Jerusalem before it's too late. And, you know, if they had not interpreted them in that way, this entire sect that we now call Christianity would have been made extinct in that horrible revolt that killed 1 million people. So they were right in thinking that they were in the end time. So should every generation think that they're in the end time? I say yes.
I mean, every time there's a war, you think it's the end time.
And that's not wrong to do. Somebody asked an Orthodox rabbi, when is the Messiah coming? And he said, every day.
Do you think there are heirs to Jesus, part of his family, the lineage, is out there somewhere?
It's one of the things I consider. In my book, we know that they extended centuries at least to the time of the Council of Nicaea, when they had a major run-in with the Roman Pope in those days, saying, look, we are the rightful heirs of this movement. They even had a term, the despoteni, they called themselves in Greek, the heirs, the lineage. We should be ruling, at least in the East, in Jerusalem and all these other cities. Well, the Pope basically sent them away and cut them off and excommunicated them. And after that, it's hard to trace them. People, again, they think that somehow the Jews rejected Jesus. I say no, it was the church, sadly, that rejected the Jews. It's the other way around. So their lineage definitely continued, but it's hard to trace. Is there some bloodline that extends even to this day? I'm sure that somewhere you could find the DNA of Jesus' own family in the Jewish world.
Somewhere.
Certainly, you can in the spiritual world. And that's what I ultimately have to look at. What is the message of Jesus? What are those mystical elements, this idea of the blood that's in this tablet that we started talking about, that can become a chariot, like Elijah's chariot, to transform humanity? That's an idea you find among the Jewish world, the Jewish mystics. And I wonder if Jesus were here today, where would he go? And I think probably to the most ultra-Orthodox synagogues and just grab a prayer book and start getting mystical.
Do the heirs, do the descendants, if they're out there, do they know who they are?
Probably not. Probably not. Because this movement was so rejected by Western Christianity, sadly, that there was nothing left for them to do but to immerse themselves back in their Jewish life. They were given basically the ultimatum. You either renounce your Jewish heritage and everything that makes you Jews and interbreed and intermarried and become Christians like the rest of us, or we excommunicate you. But they're saying, look, we already are Christians. We're more than you. And we're not going to renounce our Jewish practice. So what choice did they have? They either had to renounce their Jewish life, and some of them did. And Jews down through the centuries have occasionally converted to Christianity, and that Jewish line was basically assimilated and lost. But others said, no, even if you excommunicate us, we are not leaving our people, our heritage, and our culture. And somehow they drifted back into the Jewish woodwork. But there have always been little messianic movements that have cropped up in Jewish history. In the Middle Ages, we find them, and beyond, into the 1700s in Poland, there was a messianic figure who came up in Judaism. And I just have to ask myself if somehow remnants of at least the ideas of this dynasty of Jesus survived even within Judaism, even to the present.
Does the Bible predict what's happening now, today?
Yes, and every day. I know I'm sounding mystical here. the danger is we can't say that it pinpoints exactly this time and only this time. There are messages that should be interpreted in every time. So it's right to do that today as long as we recognize that the previous generation did it too. And the generation before that did it too. Doesn't make them wrong, does it? Because they thought they were living in the end and it didn't happen. It's a good thing. Live every day like it's the end and believe that the Bible is speaking to this day. It's a good thing to do. Even if it isn't, right? Even if we're still around for another 100 or 200 or 1,000 years, go ahead and apply it to this day. Live like this is your last day.
Always.
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 When does the Messiah come, said the rabbi? Every day.
Ken, we're going to take phone calls when we make the turn here at the top of the hour. Everybody wants an opportunity to chat with you. Of all the things you've investigated, you know, the lost ears of Jesus, the secrets of the lost Bible, the Dead Sea Scrolls, is there one area that fascinates you the most? Your pet project?
The one I'm working on most currently is always my favorite. They're kind of like my kids.
At the time, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. My books are like my kids, and people will say, "Wait, which one should I start with, or which is your favorite?" And you know, they all are really. But it's the luxury of being a professor in this type of material. It's never dry. It's never boring. And by the way, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. So right now I'm all about the heirs within Judaism, and it's not just Christian scholarship. This is good Jewish scholarship.
And what if they know who they are and they just don't publicize it? Is that possible?
Anything's possible. I'd like to meet them if they do.
Sure.
I mean, there are all kinds of stories, even about the 10 lost tribes, that they are out there somewhere. This is a tradition in the Jewish world on a mystical level, true. But there are groups of people out there. There's also the tradition, incidentally, this is interesting, that there are 36 righteous individuals. This is a bit of Kabbalah.
Tell me about this.
Mysticism. That exist and they may or may not know who they are. But every generation has 36 righteous individuals who preserve the world from total destruction. And you may be one of them. And I love this teaching.
Huh.
Because it's every person's responsibility to create the world that we live in. You want to see the messianic age come? Well, then make the world worthy enough to bring the Messiah. The beautiful Jewish teaching. Maybe you're one of those 36. Tzaddikim is the word. Tzaddik is a righteous person. Not righteous in terms of what your doctrines are, or what you think or believe, but in how you behave, in how you live your life, in your ethics, in your principles. You, on the basis of your behavior, can literally save the world.
How long are you going to be over there on your trip?
13 days this particular time. 12 disciples I have, and I'm the 13th for 13 days. It's a mystical number.
It's, interesting time over there. You know that.
Very interesting, yeah.
So one, stay safe.
Definitely. Definitely. I've lived over there for quite some time, for several years, in rather unsafe environment. So this is a piece of cake, George. I've been in Lebanon in the midst of the civil war, and it was a very trying, very hairy experience, difficult time. But that's the Middle East. It's the folks there are used to this. You live with it.
Well, you make sure you know how we can get a hold of you. You may end up being our correspondent over there, Ken.
I'd love to.
All right, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines in just a moment. Dr. Ken Hansen, our special guest, is website treasuresintime.org. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. Dr. Ken Hansen with us. Final hour. We're going to take your phone calls this hour as well. How long does it take you to fly out there, Ken?
It's a long schlep, as we call it. It's about, 12 hours or so transatlantic. Long haul. Gives us a lot to talk about on the trip.
Do you get edgy after a while? You've got to walk around the plane?
Especially when you've got Israelis on planes who always are up in the aisles, and it's a whole social gathering. It's really remarkable. And then we have a few of our Orthodox friends who decide, oh, the sun is coming up, time to pray and daven, and have a whole prayer service going on the aircraft.
Okay, to the phones we go. Sharon in Arizona, you're up with us. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how you doing? Good?
We're doing great.
Excellent.
Thanks.
Ken, my synagogue brought in a speaker who was a Dead Sea Scroll specialist, and he supposited that the Dead Sea Scrolls were actually the library from the Beit HaMikdash, that when the children of Israel, Bnei Israel, saw that the temple was about to be destroyed and they weren't getting anywhere, they took the whole library out and they put it in the Dead Sea where it would be safe. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that theory?
Yeah, that's one of the many controversies that swirls, and I'm glad for these kind of debates because they spark the public interest, and I respectfully disagree, but it's okay. I think that we're looking at the library of a single sectarian group. And the reason is that while you have a lot of various type of literature, from books of the Bible to these non-biblical books that, as I mentioned, they were banned, kicked out of the Bible, didn't make the cut, we've also got a whole host of documents, of texts, of books we didn't even know existed that have the same flavor, that use the same terminology, language like sons of light, sons of darkness. Talk about end time, very apocalyptic, a war scroll that speaks of a final battle, a series of wars at the very end of the age. And it's not just one document. These are linked together, all this language and terminology and the ideas back and forth. And to imagine that this was just the random library out of the city of Jerusalem, to me, it strains credulity. It seems like these are the specific ideas of a specific ancient Jewish sect. And as I mentioned, while they never call themselves the Essenes, that's the dominant identification, simply because we've got an ancient historian, I've talked about him several times, Josephus Flavius, who describes an ancient sectarian group lived right on the corner of the Dead Sea in a sort of monastic community, the way he describes it. When you read his writings, his history of this ancient group, and then you compare it with the scrolls themselves and the archaeology of this region, the place called Qumran, beautifully excavated. And my little group will be strolling through the remains of this ancient site called Qumran. Everything seems to fit. The caves adjacent to Qumran. So we've got the settlement all excavated. We've got the caves where the scrolls were found. We've got ancient pottery there. Everything seems to be located right on the northwest corner of the Dead Sea. So did it come out of Jerusalem as their library? I kind of doubt it.
What if you find more Dead Sea scrolls?
I would love it.
Just, they were
I'll be on the lookout. There is also the matter of the treasure. That may, in fact, have come out of the city of Jerusalem. We do have one very unusual Dead Sea scroll, different from all the others, composed on pure copper, sheets of copper riveted together. It's completely different because it's not any kind of text that we're used to. It's not Psalms or laws or a war scroll. It's an inventory of more than 200 tons of buried gold and silver with precise locations. And that might well be the temple treasure that, in fact, was taken out of the city of Jerusalem. And they just may have hid it out in the wilderness of Judea and coincidentally happens to be near where the Essenes lived.
Let's go to our first time caller, Don in Florida. Go ahead, Don.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call, and you
sure
have a
thing.
Wonderful show.
Thank you.
Two questions for your guest. I appreciate talking to him.
You got it.
I would like to know if he is aware or if he knows anything about the seven prophecies that Jesus had. And a second question is I'd like to know the name of Moses' mother.
Prophecies and Moses?
Yochebed was the name of Moses' mother, according to the biblical text itself.
Thank you.
And it means God is honored, or she is honored in God, honored of God, I guess is the best way to translate that. Jesus, in terms of prophecies, I don't know about seven in particular. The ones that most focus my attention are the ones I write about in my new book, where he is actually talking about this terrible cataclysm to strike the city of Jerusalem. And scholars have, for generations, poo-pooed this. Oh, he must not have said such things. These were added later to the text and just put in Jesus' mouth. I'm sorry, with things like this new tablet in stone that we've got, I think this is genuine, something that Jesus might have said, where he's giving warnings specifically about that horrible revolt to come against the Roman Empire. And he says, if you are in Jerusalem, get out, get out, and pray that your flight might not be in winter. And now, there's a specific prophecy in the mouth of Jesus. And why would he say something like that? Well, the Jordan River swells in the wintertime and would be unfordable, because this was the escape route for his dynasty, his descendants. They had to go east over the Jordan River and resettle in a city called Pella. And these are specific types of prophecies that are in the mouth of Jesus and I think are authentic.
You know, back to the tablet that we were talking about at the beginning of the show, they analyzed this, what, well over a year ago. How come they're just talking about it now?
I've been following this for over a year, even as I wrote my new book. Now is when it's getting the press, because just in the last week, literally just a week ago, we've had an international conference going on to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And what is one of the main topics on the table is
yep.
this tablet. And the consensus is so far that it's probably authentic. Even though there are detractors, it's probably authentic. And that's a mind blower if it's correct.
All right, next up, let's go to our wild card line. We've got you, John, in New York. Hey, John.
Hello, George. Hi, Ken. How you doing?
Good.
I just have two quick questions. If ETs actually really do exist, is there any correlation between us, them, and the Bible?
Did you ever study that, Ken?
If there's a correlation between us, ETs, and the Bible itself.
Yeah, does the Bible talk about ETs?
Repeatedly. Again, depending on how you take them. certainly E.T. in the sense of extraterrestrial. Now, did they say in the Bible these are craft from other planets, other galaxies, whatever? No. They experienced extraterrestrial as beings from somewhere else, from beyond this plane of existence. And not only the Bible, but the books that didn't make it. I write about this in Secrets from the Lost Bible. We've got numerous stories about the angels who came down, literally, and cohabited with Earth women. I mean, it even sounds like alien abductions, and spawned a race of half-breeds who grew up to enormous proportion and began devouring the inhabitants of the Earth. So you can take that in any way you want. That's what these texts, these mysterious texts, say. Now it's our job to try to interpret them, and there's no party line. You can't say this definitely means this or that. It's just out there.
All right. My second question was, doesn't a certain temple have to be completed in Jerusalem before the rapture actually occurs?
Okay, well, now that's a question in Christian theology. While I'm a Judaic scholar, I do deal with all this material as well. And it does have to do with this term I mentioned in Judaism, the Hevlei Mashiach, the pangs of the Messiah. It's in the Talmud. Before the Messiah can come, there will be this time of travail and pain and woe and anguish. And part of that has to do with what will befall the temple. The temple is to be defiled. So people ask, how can the temple be defiled when over in Jerusalem today there is no temple? We have an Islamic shrine located exactly on the spot where the temple used to be. So all of that has given rise to the speculation that the temple must be rebuilt, and there are even some Israelis, granted kind of a radical fringe, who would in fact like to see that happen, even to the point of bringing down the Dome of the Rock, I hate to say. Talk about World War III. We don't have to worry about Iran. I mean, that alone would bring on World War III. Somebody tried to
close to it.
Yeah, and it was tried, actually. The Israeli internal security, called the Shin Bet, it's their internal version of the Mossad, which is their CIA, they foiled the plot, thankfully. And jailed these radical Israelis who were involved in it, and for religious reasons, obviously. Like, you know, we don't have enough reasons to fight World War III already. We need this. So, I mean, that is all what is at stake. And imagine the way that Bible and prophecy and faith and religion all dovetail with world geopolitics today. Yikes.
Does the former Soviet Union, Russia, do they fit into any of these end-time prophecies?
It's been speculated in the past. Why? Because the early Israelite prophets invariably talked about an enemy from the north, who will come in. Well, in history, again, you got to study your history. Where do the enemies always come from? You had invaders from the north. You had King Nebuchadnezzar. Later on, you had this Syrian king that I've talked about this evening, who started the first religious persecution in history in the 2nd century B.C. It's about the time when the Essenes started their sect, sort of fleeing from the persecution. He was from the north. He was from Syria. So these are sort of prototypes, the way they appear, like cycles over and over again from the north. So that has led more modern folk to speculate this might have something to do with the Soviet Union or with Russia. Well, that remains an open question. Today there's no Soviet Union, and Israel has more of a dialogue with Russia than in the past. But we sure can say that we've had a mass wave of Jewish immigration out of Russia to Israel that, I tell you, the ancient prophets seem to foretell it when they talk about, I will bring you from the north, I will bring you on eagle's wings. Sure enough, about a million or more Soviet/Russian Jews have come out in the last couple of decades and make up a major part of the Israeli population today. It's uncanny how Bible, in fact, speaks to the modern world. Russian is all over the state of Israel today.
That's true. Let's go to our wild card light, Damon in Georgia. Go ahead, Damon.
Good evening.
There you go.
All right, thanks. I've got a couple of questions, and then I have a comment.
Okay.
And I can either listen to them offline or you can engage me. My first one is the comment you made about only the priestly class killed Jews. That's not necessarily all true. When Pilate presented Jesus to the people, he asked the people. They wasn't just all the religious class. He asked all of them, "Do you want him bound over?" And they did. Number two was I think Israel. Just my opinion. I think Israel, the Vatican, and the British Museum are sitting on a lot of information that more information than they want to let out about the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
About documents and things like that. But I think a lot of it's out there that they have it that they're sitting on, and I think in the end it's going to come out, and I think it's going to change religion. That's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And last, I watched or listened to a lot of things since 2000 about there's been a lot of information, like from the History Channel, National Geographic, things like that, about a lot of scholars and their position and what they're saying. They've overturned a lot of things on just exactly where Israel or the Hebrews got their information from. And it seems so, like you brought out, Mr. Norway, you brought out earlier about the text from Babylon. Well, mm-hmm. There was some Egyptian text, there were Babylonian text, there was all kind of texts out there. And all of the information that the Jews, the Hebrews had seems to point toward those texts that from the other lands who they were exiled to. So if these texts predate those, what they had that became the Bible, how did the Hebrews become, you know, the authority on those texts? I don't understand. Like the thing on let's just take Gilgamesh.
All right, let's let him react to some of this. Go ahead.
Great questions. Hope I can remember them all. By the way, I was one of the scholars on the History Channel that talked about the texts that came from these other lands. And what I was trying to explain at the time was that there were apparently families of texts of the Bible, the way it's come down to us, different versions of the Bible. And some apparently came from Egypt, some from Babylonian, some from the land of Israel, Palestine itself. And on what basis do we say that? Well, we have an ancient translation of the Bible into Greek that was done in Alexandria in Egypt. And while it correlates remarkably with the Bibles we have today, it's not word for word identical, the Septuagint version, as it's called. So it seems like it's a slightly variant version of the Bible. I know this is complex, but there were families of biblical texts. Say if a book today is translated into different languages, well, you'd end up with families of the same book in different languages, and you'd have to ask, what are the variations here? Then the standard one that's come down to us today is probably the one from Babylonia, but we have even a different version of the Torah, the books of Moses itself, produced by a sect called the Samaritans in the land of Israel, the Samaritan Pentateuch, and this is a formal text. The Samaritans are still around. They're still there in Israel today. And if you come up to them, they'll bring out their Samaritan Pentateuch and show it to you in their own special script. And they swear that this is the one that this is the right one. This is the one Moses gave. And Moses deposited it here in Samaria. Fascinating stuff. They all agree remarkably, but they're not word for word identical. And that's where the scholars get involved with these minor variations. Like I mentioned, the height of Goliath is one of those variations. There are scores of these. That's one question. The other one had to do with...
Let's go back to him. We've got a minute left. Go ahead for your other question, Damon.
Okay.
I want to address, since we got a minute left, more important than any, is about who killed Jesus as a Judaic scholar.
Right. And he's right. Didn't Pilate bring him out?
Right, he did, yes.
Yeah, there was a crowd, sure. But who organized the crowd? If you read the gospel text carefully, I'm not quibbling with the gospel text,
which a lot of scholars do. These minimalists will try to shred the Gospels. I'm a Judaic scholar who trusts the Gospels, in fact. But they show us that the crowd is in the pocket of the Sadducean high priests who are orchestrating the whole thing. If you go to Iran today, well, they can whip up a crowd anytime they want, can't they, and have them shout anything that they want. But when you look at the actual reaction of the folks, the common people, even the women who are depicted in those days, Jesus speaks to them as weeping on his behalf. Who are these women? These are from the common folk, the common class, the Pharisees, incidentally, who unfortunately Christians love to bash. It's a shame because it's led to a lot of anti-Semitism. We're actually on Jesus' side, and that is something I'd really like to stress. You know, it wasn't the Jews who rejected Jesus.
Well, we will be right back, Ken. We'll be back and take final calls. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Ken Hansen and your calls, and we'll go to final calls right now. Deborah in Wisconsin, take it away. Hey, Deborah.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have two disputes with your guest.
Okay.
One of which is he referred to this recent archaeological find, the tablet, as the first archaeological find regarding Christ, and I just wanted to point out, I'm sure he's aware that the Dead Sea Scrolls included the book of Isaiah, which has many references as to the coming of Christ, his death, his resurrection, how he would die, that he would be numbered between two criminals, that he would be buried with the rich, and was a rich Jew, Joseph of Arimathea, who provided the burial for him. So I was really surprised he said that, because the book of Isaiah is part of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Well, he's here listening away. Go ahead, Ken.
Oh, my. We can talk for hours about the book of Isaiah, and it's one of the subjects that we teach at the university in our Judaic Studies program. Of course, not everybody, especially in the Jewish world, accepts the book of Isaiah the way Christians do. How much of this is really messianic? How much of this refers specifically to Jesus?
Wait, could you back up for a moment? You were saying not many in the Christian, not many in the Jewish community, what?
I said not everybody in the Jewish world especially accepts the idea that Isaiah is specifically talking about Jesus. But then again, it's not really that important, because what's important is this idea about the Messiah, the Messianic age. And even, in Judaism, there are multiple Messiahs. Did you know that? The word Mashiach actually means anointed one. And who was the first anointed one? According to the Bible, it's King David. What about King Solomon? What about the book of Zechariah that speaks of the governor Zerubbabel, who leads the Jewish exiles back from Babylonian captivity, speaks of him as the Messiah, as the Mashiach. Hello?
Where'd she go? You there, Deborah?
So I'd like to jump to the second issue I have a problem with. You were saying that the book of Revelation, it was, in fact, did refer to, like, the 70 years past Christ's birth. That was accurate, but it also refers to the future. And in the 12th chapter in the book of Revelation, and I see this even in the Christian community, and it breaks my heart, because the 12th chapter refers to the woman. The woman who gives birth and bore a male child.
Oh, yes.
And it's the nation of Israel. And I see even in the Christian, certain corners of the Christian community, an anti-Semitic blind spot when it comes to the Jews. Christ was a Jew. The New Testament, his followers were, he was supported by the Jewish people. It was the religious people that hated him. But my whole point is, in the 12th chapter in the book of Revelation, when it talks about the woman and the serpent coming after the woman, because the woman gave birth to the male child, and it says in the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation that he will make war with the rest of her offspring. And if anyone has eyes to see, in reading the 12th chapter, it explains why there has been throughout history, and even regrettably in certain corners of the Christian community, anti-Semitic
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned it. I mean, and this is one of the things, one of the important things that I do as a professor is to deal with the origin and the roots of this. It really began in religion, and it ended in Auschwitz and continues even beyond that. These things are all linked. So I talk about this sort of thing a lot, and I don't want to dump on anybody or any religious group or be unkind in talking about certain blindness in the Christian community. But, okay, you mentioned it. So yeah, it's there. But my admonition is these prophecies, all of them have multiple fulfillments. And whatever your religious perspective, I mean, I commend it, and I like to see these multiple fulfillments. So if you want to see Jesus in Isaiah, then see Jesus in Isaiah. I have students who are Muslim, who are Christians, who are Jews, and I have to commend everybody's faith, okay? But you really need to read my new book with regard to the woman. I love this image, the woman in Revelation chapter 12, who, you can see the modern state of Israel in the woman, but the immediate reference was to the heirs of Jesus. Who was the woman? We think of Mary. We also think of a corporate emblem of the Nazarene movement. You can't even call them the church. They call themselves the Nazarenes or the believers. This was the woman who was in travail, and it talks about her child who is pursued, and a dragon spews water out of his mouth. That's the Jordan River. I mentioned earlier how the early line of Jesus' family had to flee east across the Jordan, and Jesus said, "Pray your flight not be in winter." All of this imagery links together here. This is an image. It's an oracle, essentially, telling the early believers, the followers, the family of Jesus, you're in the end time now. Get out. Flee Jerusalem before it's too late. They save themselves from the horrible catastrophe of the first century.
Okay, back to the phones we go. East of the Rockies. Frank in New York. Hey, Frank.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Ken and George. It's very interesting to have such a stimulating hermeneutical discussion. And I wanted to say that I really enjoyed, Ken, your last comment about multiple fulfillments, because listening to this and having spent many years pursuing hermeneutics and comparative religion, I was just thinking of, you know, Elaine Pagel's great works regarding Gnostic texts and what actually is a sacred text and what could be a sacred text. And ultimately, it all depends on one's interpretation.
Sure does.
And if we go to, let's say, Max Weber's definition of religion as a social construct, mm-hmm. it can also be a regime of repression.
Yeah.
And in a sense, if we look at sort of the problems with orthodoxy that we have with all of the great religions of the book, all the monotheistic religions,
yeah.
It's interesting to note that all interpretation changes,
yeah,
and
yeah.
that different texts have an impact and influence. Right now, we can do a linear analysis and say that Josephus's histories have been rewritten over the last, 1,500 years,
mm-hmm.
and we have to realize, in a sense, that we can't let the orthodoxy of the quote-unquote sacred texts or the persuasive fictions bifurcate spirituality, because
right.
it does delineate
well
what
said.
Is defined as a religion. And in the spirit of humanity and sort of growth and enlightenment, I think we have to respect all traditions, but at the same time realize that the reader's interpretation is sovereign. And if he or she picks or chooses from the sacred text that which will enhance one's spirituality, it's worthwhile. And we have to always
yes.
be aware that we can read the work metaphorically, as I tell Calvino.
As we say in church, preach it.
Pardon me?
As we say in church, preach it.
Yes.
I like what you're saying, yeah. And really, we have to be so careful, as you say, about a regime of repression. That's not what we want to do with spirituality. So the beautiful thing is to be able to welcome all interpretations and recognize that each individual reader or listener has their own interpretation that needs to be sovereign for that person. Why not let there be multiple fulfillments?
All right. Thank you, Ken, for that. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line, Richard in Fresno. Hey, Richard.
How you doing? Thank you, Dr. Hansen, for taking my call. I have two questions for you. Have you ever heard of Ron Wyatt? He's an archaeologist
mm-hmm.
in the 70s and the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to look at any of his DVDs? And if so, what are your comments on those works?
And I believe he believes that he found Noah's Ark, right?
That was one. Another one was Sodom and Gomorrah. Another one was where the Jews crossed the Red Sea. There were pillars on either side with markings. But the most interesting DVD, I think, was the one on the Ark of the Covenant, which he believes that he found underneath the place where Jesus was crucified.
Yeah, and I've been down there, by the way, underneath the place where Jesus was crucified, and we'll be there again within the week. I've not seen anything that would lead me to think that the Ark is down there, but I do think that the original tomb is down there in one of those tombs. We've got first century tombs, very authentic, right directly underneath where Jesus was crucified, Calvary, in the underground caverns of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Skeptical about the Ark of the Covenant, but there are so many different things you touch on. Everybody has their own ideas, and we have to welcome all of them and then, let's say, study them. I've got my own idea about the crossing of the Red Sea, and I do connect it with the explosion on the island of Santorini that would have inundated the whole Nile Delta region. And so I'm on board with those who place it in what today really is dry ground. It used to be the Nile Delta, and it would have this explosion 10 times more powerful than Krakatoa would have devastated everything in the whole ancient Near East, certainly Egypt. That's my take on that. But you know, we're open-minded, and we say, you know, if you've got more evidence, show me.
Okay, lastly, what is your personal opinion on the rapture? I know you referenced the pangs and the cyclical pangs we've had for the last 2,000 years. So what are your personal thoughts about the rapture as the Christians?
Look, well, again, I'm a Judaic scholar. I do deal with New Testament. So my feeling is that the book of Revelation is talking more directly about the first century events, and that we can only then cyclically apply it down through every generation, including our own. And I have always been a little reticent about imagining what Christianity speaks of as a rapture, because to me, as I'm looking at the dynasty of Jesus, I see what for them was a real rescue and escape and a quote-unquote rapture of being taken out of the city of Jerusalem during the most horrific, violent war that the land had ever experienced. That, to them, was the rapture. And in terms of future multiple fulfillments, I just back off. I'm not too excited about the idea of saying, you know, let's all faithful people will just bail out and abandon the world to destruction. Wouldn't it be nice to actually remain in it, even through the hard time, even through those pangs of the Messiah, which is the Jewish idea, and to help, as maybe one of those 36 righteous people scattered in the world, help to ourselves to bring about the redemption.
Let's go to Pete. Driving around in Washington. Go ahead, Pete.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Dr. Hansen.
Good morning.
My rabbi, he teaches a concept about the two messiahs, as you spoke of earlier, the messiah from the house of Joseph and the messiah from the house of David.
Yes.
And he teaches as like in the Torah where it says, if a man divorces his wife, he can't take her back lest he be defiled. Then he teaches from Jeremiah where the house of Israel was divorced. And he teaches that the Messiah had to come and die, who was actually Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and ordered to redeem Israel back, as is spoken of in a prophecy, saying that he would redeem Israel. But Judah was never divorced. And I was wondering if you've ever heard of that teaching or concept on the two messiahs.
I have actually, and I'm a little reticent about thinking that Judah was never divorced, to be honest. But what I do see is how your comments dovetail so much with what this new tablet is talking about, that the Messiah must come and die. Even in multiple fulfillments, the original reference was to this Simon character in the first century BC, and now we have a subsequent fulfillment, if you will, in Jesus. But the Messiah must come and sacrifice and die in order to bring about a restoration for Israel, and so the tablet has the spirit of the Davidic Messiah speaking to the Messiah, son of Joseph. Via the intercession of the angel Gabriel, conveying this idea that the blood, your blood and the blood of all these slain, will be a chariot that will rise up to God like Elijah and will ultimately cause righteousness to triumph. And that also dovetailing with our previous call, you know, there's this idea of suffering through it. Suffering through the hardship and the trial and the agony, and that even in the catastrophe will bring about the redemption of Israel.
You're like a walking encyclopedia, Dr. Ken.
not as much as the ancients. Let me tell you, they knew it. They memorized it.
They sure did. Time for one or two more. That's it. Nick in California. Go ahead, Nick.
All right. Thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
I got a question regarding the rapture. Let me mention first that I'm a big-time atheist, and I don't believe any of these. The farther they go, they're just stories, not facts. But anyways,
everybody, atheists included.
Yes, the reason I come to that conclusion that I'm an atheist is because questions like these that I ask, that I'm going to ask you right now, regarding the rapture. I know you said you're not a scholar on it, but just simply when believers say that Jesus is going to come down, we have no way of knowing how Jesus looks like. The only portrait or pictures or paintings we have is from the 1600s. So if these people believe that Jesus is going to come down and all the rest of the things that come along with the story, how are they, they can simply be fooled. How are they going to know how Jesus looks like? I mean, it's just simple stuff like that I ask myself. And that's really the conclusion that I now, I've always been an atheist, even since I was a little kid. These things are just so bizarre. I mean, yes.
Well, back to our previous caller who talked about a regime of repression that can develop when people become too tight in terms of what they believe and how they believe it. Again, I'm a Jewish scholar, a scholar of Judaica, and Judaism has always been open on the level of meaning and interpretation, but tight on the level of behavior. In other words, it tries to regulate how we live our lives, but you can believe pretty much anything you want to believe, and it doesn't make you a bad person. And I love that idea. So let's not get in this regime of repression and say, you know, the Messiah must be exactly this way, and he must be Jesus, and he must come back exactly in this particular fashion. We don't know. And in fact, Jewish thinking and mystical thinking allows you even to conceive of a messianic age as opposed to an individual appearance in the sky of someone with a robe and a beard who looks like what we imagine is Jesus.
Ken Hansen, my friend, we're out of time. I want to thank you again for being on the program. Do give us your phone number when you're in Israel, because who knows what could happen there. Thank you, Ken.
It's my pleasure.
For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.